This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to the story of one of the most iconic songs of the 1990s. That was also a political anthem. Tub Thumping came out in 1997 and is still well known to this day. But few know the story of the anarcho-pop band behind it, Chumbawamba. Now, Chumbawamba's former singer is working on a film that looks at that history and how artists can use their voices in times of crisis.
At the time, I really thought I could change the world. I'll put a stop to all of this madness. Make a difference in the midst of all this chaos. But that was way back when. Yes, this is someone who was someone once. Someone who truly believed he was at the forefront of the revolutionary vanguard, that he was the voice of the people. But now? Now this is someone who'll only be remembered as a one-hit wonder in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. A washed-up, rinsed-out, retired radical. Yes, this is someone who was someone once.
From I Get Knocked Down, the untold story of Chumbawamba. And for more, we're joined by its director, Dunstan Bruce. He's also a founding member of Chumbawamba. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Glad you made the leap across the pond for a few seconds. So talk about this remarkable group that you were a lead singer in.
We formed in 1982. On the back of the punk movement, and we were involved in the anarcho-punk movement in Britain that was largely connected with a band called Crass, who described themselves as anarchists, and that introduced us as a band to the concept of anarchism, and we sort of embraced it. We squatted a house together in Leeds. We lived communally.
How many of you were there?
There's always been about eight of us in the band, but there's about 12 of us living in the house. We lived our lives trying to follow anarchist principles, and we had a band, and we thought that it was incumbent of us to do something political in the music that we were creating. And so that's when we started, and then... We kept going for 30 years.
So talk about the progression of the band, and you are doing it in this piece, in this film, and why you chose to make a film.
Partly because I think what happened is because the band ended in, 2012. I was sort of a little bit concerned that the history of the band was going to be written out of musical history, and I think what we'd done was could be of some inspiration to a lot of other people, and I thought it was important to talk about the fact that you can combine politics and music and do something that had an impact on the world. And I'd reached the age of 50, and I thought, what am I doing with my life? Where am I going? Where do I fit in? And I just thought it was at that point I thought, look, this is a really important story that should be told, because you've got to imagine that that Tub Thumping is the very small tip of a very, very large iceberg. A lot of people only know us for that one song.
So talk about that. Talk about your lead up to Tub Thumping and what it meant, how you broke through, to say the least, to the mainstream, and talk about the success of this one song.
Yeah, having that song be a hit was a complete surprise. It wasn't a plan. We just signed to a major record label, but had already written the song, and it was a combination of circumstance and luck that meant that song came along at a time when it caught people's imaginations, and it just went absolutely crazy.
I want to go to a clip of your group of Chumbawamba performing the hit song Tub Thumping, which features the memorable lyrics, "I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down." Now, what's significant about this particular clip is that this moment of the song being played was on David Letterman's show in 1997. And you sort of did a little improvisation for this global audience when one of the choruses was turned into "Free Mumia Abu Jamal." Thumping on the David Letterman show in 1997 with new lyrics made for that moment, talking about Free Mumia Abu Jamal, who had been imprisoned a few years before that for a crime he says he was unfairly convicted of, killing a police officer. He remains in jail. He was on death row for more than two decades. Our guest is Dunstan Bruce of Chumbawamba, making a film about it, also one of the lead singers in it for many years. Talk about your experience on the David Letterman show, how you got there, how you sang the song. It wasn't live, so they could decide whether or not to play it.
I think what happened was when we had that, when the song went global and when it was a huge hit over in the States, we made a decision about what we would do having that platform. We'd existed on an underground scene for years, on the periphery of the mainstream, and then suddenly we found ourselves right in the belly of the beast. And we made a decision that, look, we've got to have fun with this, and we've got to do something with it. We've got to use that platform, because it's not how often does anybody get that sort of global audience to be able to use it for something? And we just decided that we were involved in the Mumia campaign, and we thought this is an opportunity to do something. And we just thought, okay, we'll change the lyrics. And we did this a few times. We did it on Jay Leno as well, and then we famously changed the lyrics at the Brits as well. So it was something that we did as a matter of course. With the Letterman show, we didn't tell them we were going to do it, obviously, and then we recorded it. I think we went off to do a show at Irving Plaza straight afterwards or something like that. But what happened was that they then the record label then got into a big discussion with Letterman's people about whether they were going to actually, whether they could still broadcast it, and they did. And so what was significant for us was that it felt as though, because we got a lot of criticism for signing to a major label, for having a hit single, for entering the mainstream, and it just felt that point that made it feel worthwhile to us that we were trying to do something with the position we were in. And we were using, that was just one example of us trying to use that platform to talk about other things that were far more important and far more interesting than just being a pop band.
So talk about the Mumia Abu-Jamal moment after it did broadcast. What kind of response did you get to it?
We were so happily oblivious to a lot of it, because then we went on to do something, you know, we'd go and do it on Jay Leno, and then we'd go on Barbara Walters and talk about anarchism with Barbara Walters, which was all, you know, it was like a whirlwind. It was a roller coaster we were on. We were just aware of the fact that we were leaving this trail of chaos behind us that the record company had to deal with.
Who was the record company?
It was Republic Records, based in New York. It was the Lipman brothers who had to deal with it all. So we had a great, you know, we had a great time. It was always far more interesting causing trouble than towing the line. And so we weren't career musicians. We were passionate about our politics and what we wanted to do, why we were in a band and what we wanted to do with that position. And so that seemed like the perfect opportunity to mess things up or have fun with it.
Now, David Letterman, the show, did put a caption at the end of the show that said, "Views of performers does not represent David Letterman," or something along those lines. Is that right?
That's brilliant. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
You mean you're learning for the first time that you did not represent David Letterman's views?
Yeah.
He was not singing the same tune.
I suspected that he had it, yeah.
Okay, but now let's move 1 year later, within a year. You're back in Britain, and you're about to win a major award, right? The Brits, Brit Awards. Now, for an American audience, if you can explain what that is and if you can talk about this moment.
I don't know what the equivalent would be over here. Would it be the Grammys or something like that? I don't know. Mm. It was on that sort of scale. It was the biggest music awards ceremony definitely in Britain, maybe in Europe. We were up for Best Single of 1997. We'd been asked whether we would play at the awards ceremony. We were like, no, we're not going to play at that. It's not our sort of thing. And then we eventually got cajoled into doing it because we were allowed to show a film. We made our own film that was the backdrop, that was all about various protests around the world that were going on at the time. And we changed the words again to the chorus because it was the previous May. The New Labour had just been elected as the British government, and
John Prescott was the Prime Minister.
John Prescott was the Deputy Prime Minister, yeah. But what was interesting, that we'd been involved in a dockers' strike that had taken place in Liverpool, and we'd just done a huge benefit for them down in London. And then because we had this awards ceremony, we invited a couple of them along to the ceremony with us. So if we did win the award, they were going to go up, because at that time it was live, they were going to go up, collect the award and say something about their situation and their with their strike. And somebody spotted that John Prescott had turned up at this award, because at that point New Labour were trying to cozy up with musicians and artists. You know, they would have like Oasis turning up at Downing Street for, you know, and it was all like just for press publicity sort of stuff. But the dockers we were with said that that Prescott had deliberately shunned them. He'd been a member of the union that they were involved in, and he refused to help them resolve this dispute. And so it was one of those occasions where, you know, we'd all been drinking. I can't deny that we'd all had a bit to drink, and we'd all cajoled Damba and Alice into doing something about the fact that Prescott had turned up. And so they went and threw some iced water over John Prescott and said, "This is for the Liverpool Dockers." And that caused a lot of trouble for...
Wait, who exactly poured the ice bucket over his head?
Damba did, and Alice... Both did, yeah.
Alice Nutter?
Yes, yeah. But it was Damba who got caught. basically.
And what happened to him?
They sort of arrested him for about half an hour, and then Prescott said he wasn't going to press charges, so then they released him. But then it was like, then we just were all over all the tabloids for like the next week or so.
You didn't win.
We didn't win.
That night.
Oh, no, no, no. We kind of won.
You certainly won a lot of attention.
Yeah. I think people remember more than whoever won Best Single in 1997.
So where did you go from there?
There was a massive backlash. There was a huge, huge backlash in Britain in particular because of that, because a lot of people were quite keen on the fact that New Labour had just come into power.
We're talking about Tony Blair as Prime Minister.
Tony Blair, yeah.
Prescott was his deputy.
Yeah. So we were vilified, but at the same time, we enjoyed the fact that we could, again, get into this position and say something about why we'd soaked, you know, why we'd soaked Prescott and bring the issue of...
Why you soaked him.
Yeah. So bringing up the issue of why we'd done it was important to us.
And what did Prescott say about it?
He was... I'm trying to think. When we split up, he tweeted about the fact that we'd split up and made a joke about him buying... that he was going to buy our greatest hit album. So it was funny, really, because he sort of, like, still had a sense of humour about it. But he got a lot of flack. Somebody else at some other point years later hit him, threw an egg at him as well or something. I don't know. He seemed to be, like... he was sort of a bit of a buffoon. I think he was like a Boris Johnson type before Boris Johnson came along. And so it felt like he became a target, really. But a lot of people were upset because they regarded him as the only working class member of that cabinet, which seemed ridiculous to us because he had completely been subsumed in this world where he had... To us, it felt like he'd completely betrayed his roots and forgotten where he'd come from.
What does anarcho-pop mean to you, Dunstan? What is that phrase, that kind of music?
I suppose we came out of this anarcho-punk thing. You know, when we first started, I think we thought that how you expressed your anger about the world was by shouting about the world. I think we pretty soon realised that that wasn't necessarily the best way to do it. And that you're not going to reach a particularly wide audience by doing that. I think we were all from small northern towns. All our roots were in small working class communities, rather than any sort of middle class bourgeois existence. We hadn't come from that. We'd come from working class towns, and it felt like how we'd learnt about punk, for instance, was through mainstream media. And it was through seeing people on television singing about stuff that I thought, wow, that's amazing, when I first saw the Sex Pistols, when I first saw the Clash. And it was because not only were they saying something, they were writing music that had a tune. And I think we allowed our love of pop music to come through our own music. And so it was all about combining our politics with a good tune, really.
Well, I want to jump forward to now, when we just played one of your songs during a break, during the Charlottesville protests of the proud, self-proclaimed neo-Nazis, fascists, Klansmen, hundreds of them carrying torches through the University of Virginia. And ultimately, one of them rammed a car into a crowd of anti-fascist protesters and killed a young woman named Heather Heyer. We played On the Day the Nazi Died. This is your song from 1994. Can you talk about this? Because while they talk about you as a one-hit wonder, Chumbawamba, you've had some amazing songs leading up to that.
It's weird, really, because Tub Thumping is not Chumbawamba's best song. It's not the most political song we've ever written. And it's like, I would like to think of it as a sort of a gateway song to the rest of the iceberg of everything that Chumbawamba did. I mean, we put out about 15 albums in total. The Day the Nazi Died, along with another song called Enough is Enough that we recorded in the early to mid-90s...
Enough is Enough.
Yeah, was based on the idea that there was a rise of the right in Europe, particularly, I remember Jörg Haider in Austria, who was a right-wing politician who inspired us to start writing songs about us taking care to not let the right rise again. And that sadly is it still feels as though it's as relevant now as it was 20 years ago, if not more so. So it was at that point in time, we just thought this is just an isolated instance of the right getting a toehold in the larger political system. But it seems as though that's become larger and larger.
So let's go to on the day the Nazi died.
Nazis vanished without a trace, but battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45, but they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst Hess remained imprisoned, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise. So why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Until every Nazi dies. Did you ever think that about it being relevant almost a quarter of a century later, where we are now in 2017?
Not really, no. We thought that would have been an isolated incident, that it would be quashed by now. And that obviously is not the case. And it seems as though the right wing are getting bolder with expressing their politics, and that right wing movement seems to be getting larger and larger.
I want to go to another song on anarchy, the album called Homophobia. The lyrics are homophobia, the worst disease. You can't love who you want to love in times like these. Again, this is a song that you performed in 1994. Was Homophobia on the Anarchy album, Dunstan Bruce. Talk about the origins of this, who wrote it, what you felt like singing it, the response you got to it.
That song came out of a homophobic attack that took place in Bradford, which was the town next door to Leeds where we lived, where a young boy was killed purely because of his sexuality. And It was something that at the time there was sort of like a burgeoning gay scene in Leeds that we were a part of, which seemed really exciting. We couldn't believe that at the same time it was still dangerous. The 90s were a very celebratory time. The 80s, it seemed a bit black and white in comparison, and then the 90s seemed a lot more colourful. And part of that was because of rave culture and drug culture, and the idea that we were all seemed to be having a much better time. And you know, having fun, and it just seemed like a massive shock to the system that this sort of hateful crime could still be, you know, these sort of hateful crimes were still going on at that time. So we were inspired to write Homophobia on the back of that.
This is a clip from the Chumbawamba Mail Order EP. Explain what an EP is.
Oh, it's just like longer than a single, so it's like 8 minutes long, I think. Extended play, I think.
Extended play. Yeah. In Memoriam, Margaret Thatcher, So Long, So Long, live in Bristol. Recorded actually a year after you left, right? You left the band in 2004. This is 2004. It was available for pre-order, the band promising to send it out on the day of former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's death so that fans could, quote, rest easy in the knowledge you've put a down payment on a small and perfectly formed segment of the celebrations, you all wrote. Chumbawamba is In Memoriam, Margaret Thatcher, So Long, So Long, live in Bristol. The band also issuing a statement upon her death in 2013 that ended, quote, our deepest sympathies go out to the families of all Margaret Thatcher's victims. Now, Dunstan, you were a member of the band for a long time, but you had just left. Talk about this EP, this extended play record.
I think, you know, Thatcher is our Reagan, I suppose, that they were there. She came into power in 1979 in the UK. She was responsible for the complete destruction of the mining industry in the UK. We were heavily involved in the miners' strike in 1984-85. We did a lot of benefit shows for them. We went out picketing with them. We collected for them. Her heartless treatment her attempts to destroy the working classes in Britain has stayed with a lot of people. She was so, so hated and vilified as a politician. And so it was something, it's still a point of unity for a lot of people. It brings a lot of people together. Their sort of collective hatred of Margaret Thatcher and everything that she stood for and what she did to the working classes in Britain and how she sort of systematically destroyed communities and people's livelihoods.
Did the group actually send out the records after she died?
Yes, they did, yes. Yeah, yeah. It was available.
Can you get it anymore?
No, you can't. You can probably download it from somewhere, I'm sure. I'm sure it's still available somewhere, yeah.
How many people pre-ordered the album?
I'm not altogether sure. I don't know.
You better find out because you're making a documentary about your group, Chumbawamba.
Yeah, that song's not really part of my history because it happened after I'd left. So the story the film is as much about my journey as it is about the story of the band. And the film originally started as the idea that it was about what do you do when you get into that position, you know, and you have that platform, what can you actually do with it? And then, and I suppose my story is that I left Chumbawamba along with Dan Burt and Alice and Harry all at the same time. And then we all went out and found other things to do, we all got involved in different sort of political activities.
What about the money that you made? Talk about, you had, what, prize money, record money. Where did you put it?
What we found was really liberating for us was that we suddenly did find that we had a lot more money because of the money we made from the record. And so we were in a position where we could help a lot of organisations and a lot of community action groups and a lot of people who previously we would only been able to give a couple of £100 to. We could now give a couple of £1,000 to instead. One of the points at which I thought this is really good, the position we're in, is we once agreed for General Motors to use a song for an advert to advertise a Pontiac car. And what we did with the money was, prior to agreeing to doing it, we talked to Indie Media and we talked to another group called Corp Watch and said, look, we're going to give them this song to use for this advert.
This is for General Motors.
For General Motors. But
and they're going to give you how much?
We want you to have the money. So they gave us, I don't know, say it was £100,000. So we ended up sharing that money to, gave half to Corp Watch, who actually monitored the bad working practices of General Motors and gave the other half to Indie Media. So at that point, we thought...
What was the song they wanted?
It was a song called Pass It Along. It didn't really matter. It was just the fact that they wanted something from us. We could provide it, and then we thought, well, let's turn this on its head and use our position to do something worthwhile with the money. So that was, you know, that was one of those points where we thought, this is really good. This is what we're doing is, you know, we're making a difference, and that felt really important.
So talk about, well, Alice Nutter, one of the main mainstays of Chumbawamba. In 1998, right around the time of the ice bucket dousing of the deputy prime minister, going on the U.S. talk show Politically Incorrect and saying, if you can't afford our music, steal it from the stores, like HMV and other places.
Virgin in particular were really, really upset about it. And they withdrew all their copies of the album from all their stores, and all they did was create more interest in the record and in the band. So it sort of backfired in a way for them. We weren't particularly bothered if people stole the record or not. It didn't make much of a difference to us whether they were stealing or not. We wanted to talk more about poverty and why people have to steal. You know, why people shoplift and why people have to find ways of operating in, you know, alternative economies to make a living or to make ends meet. And so that was just an opportunity to say, you know, like, this is, you know, there's an inequality in society. We have to do something about it. We don't care if people steal our records. We're not in it to try and make as much money as possible. We're in it to say something of, you know, we're in it to talk about the injustices in the world.
So as you go back in time now, Dunstan, and you start to make this film, I mean, you left in 2004. It's more than a decade later. What does this mean for you personally?
It's sort of a personal journey as well as a discovering what the band was about. I think the story of the bands are really important. Can be a blueprint for other bands to follow, maybe. It can be inspiring for people to think, look, people have always tried to do something, and especially today, when it just feels really important and almost a responsibility for creative people to say something in the position they're in. I think it was something that we always tried to do and was something that we hope that other people will follow, you know, as an example and see. And, you know, it's not that we ever wanted to be... We didn't set out to be famous. We set out to try and change the world or leave our, you know, like, help to change the world. And so I think that's an important part. At this juncture, I think that's an important and relevant message for a lot of people.
I want to go back to Brexit.
Oh, yeah.
The day of the Brexit vote, the next morning, Donald Trump was in Scotland dedicating his golf course. The world's media was there. He hadn't been elected yet. Because here was this candidate who was flying into Scotland, you know, to—and Brexit had just happened. They wanted to hear a presidential candidate, what he had to say. And he proceeded to show people his golf course. Talk about, you know, that you could rent the rooms behind him, how historic it was, the kind of views you had. But right before he did this, right as he was taking the microphone, a young man who was dressed up with a Trump Thornberry or Thornberry Trump sweater said, "Everyone, just 1 minute, please. 1 minute, please. Mr. Trump is about to speak, but I just want to let you know that his balls are available in the golf shop, in the pro shop." And he was holding up golf balls that had Nazi swastikas on them. We didn't know who the audience was on this windswept area, but they soon jumped on him. It was clear it was mainly Secret Service. And we didn't hear much about him after that. But it was this remarkable moment where Brexit had taken place, and Trump was there to talk about renting rooms in his in his golf resort. What about Brexit, and what about Donald Trump, what they mean to you?
They both became a sort of an inspiration for to make this film as much about what's going on today than what happened to Chumbawamba 20 years ago, because I mean both things I regard as a complete and utter disaster, even though I can see, you know, what might be wrong with the machinations of the EU. I think what it stood for and what we learned from it was how we were lied to, how the whole country was lied to. And I think all this stuff, and I think the same thing happened in the States, that it's the power of the elite finding a way of convincing the less informed about what is supposed to be the truth. And I think that was, I think it was, it felt like a war, for me, it felt like a watershed moment that this has gone on, this has always happened, this has always gone on. And it felt like it was blatant. It was blatant. There'd been a period of time where it was just blatant lying. And yet, the Brexit thing, they won. I didn't expect them to win. And it felt as though those in power are so obsessed with the idea of holding on to the actual idea of you can't question the fact that even though the vote was so close and everybody was lied to, that that idea of democracy, you know, of the democratic process, which was important for them to keep their power, that they could, that this sort of thing had to happen. And I think it's an absolute mess. I think we're in an absolute mess at the time.
What are your thoughts on Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader today?
Weirdly, that's an interesting point, because I found myself last year campaigning for our Labour candidate in Brighton, because I just thought Corbyn was so vilified by all the press in the UK prior to the election. He had no friends in any of the newspapers. And I think his relative success in that election was an indication that, to me, was that media was losing its grip on what society was thinking. And I think it was fascinating to see, for instance, the number of young people who came out to vote for Corbyn. I think it was fascinating to see the shift in people's desire for change and for radical change, and I think what Corbyn stood for was far more noble than what anybody else had ever included in their manifestos before then. So I thought it was a very important moment for people to start to engage in that political process. And it's not that I think that voting will change is necessarily the way to change the world, but I think it's one thing that we've got to do, and it'll move us in the right direction. And it means that we've got to try and hold on to the things that we've got. And in the UK, that's stuff like, you know, the NHS, for instance, which obviously the Tories are completely trying to destroy. And I think it's important that we try and win those sort of victories. And so I thought it was, despite what I would regard as my anarchist far-left politics, I thought this is a moment where we've got to, you know, work together.
Wasn't your second album in 1987 titled "Never Mind the Ballots, Here's the Rest of Your Lives"?
That was an anti-voting album. But I think what people misinterpret is the idea that it's not what we were trying to say was. It's not that moment that you go into a ballot box and put an X on a piece of paper. It's what you do with the rest of the time. And it's how you organise, and it's how you agitate, and it's how you try and change the world in all the other times. It's not just about going to that point in time and doing that and then thinking that's it and leaving it to other people. It's about taking responsibility for things yourself as well.
Dunstan, I wanted to go back to you making this documentary and this moment in the film of you gathering all the band members over the years and reuniting.
Sorry, we haven't seen very many slides before. We have another conversation, but we have to have a conversation about what happened at the Brits.
Do we need to tell the story?
The setup is this enormous arena. Tables, you know, they serve dinner and serve champagne. And by every table, there's a big bucket which had the champagne and chilled wine in it. Background. Paul, the bass player, I believe, said, "Ooh, John Prescott's sat over there. Ooh, what can we do?" And we're all drunk by this point. "Ooh, we should go throw water on
him." No, rewind it a bit. Yeah. We were with Dockers.
Yeah, I want to get to that. But you tell that.
And we're there, we're going to go on stage if we won a Brit, and then we didn't win.
And All Saints won it.
So the Dockers, Mickey Ty and his wife Sylvia, were really down. And so realising Prescott were at the next table, it wasn't just, "Oh, like, what shall we do to him?" It were a bit like, "Well, they sold the Dockers out." And so Paul went round us saying, "Prescott's over there, who's up for it?"
My memory of it is that me and Buff were going down, "But what are you going to do, Prescott?"
Maybe it was, but yeah.
That's what I think my memory is of everything that we ever did.
I was saying there's Prescott, Joan Dambert, anybody else?
No.
I would have been saying, "Brilliant, come on, let's do something," but look, hanging back just a little bit.
Yeah. I was just thinking, what the f*** is Prescott doing here?
Yeah.
It's just like, right, it's just all coming into drunken focus. I'm over at his table, Alice and Paul are over there, there's ice buckets everywhere. There's a photographer on the balcony. I said to the photographer, "Get ready." And I nudged him, and then I just jumped on the table with the ice bucket, and I said, "This is for the Liverpool dock workers," and drenched him, and then he got up and pushed me off the table.
Right, as you drenched him front, and Paul tipped another 10 pints of water on his head.
And he probably got wetter from them than me, because he could see me.
But then they arrested Dan.
And then he came back, word came back, "Mr Prescott has decided he's not going to press charges." I was, "Oh, see you, Dan."
That's a clip from I Get Knocked Down, the untold story of Chumbawamba. Talk about this moment when you all came together, and describe where you came together.
OK, so we all came together in this mill near Leeds, where we found this room where we could all get together and we were all going to have a discussion about what we did as a group. Because one of the successes of the band is just the fact that we've remained friends for all that time and we're still all involved in various political activities, all involved in various creative activities and all still collaborate with each other, still work together and still have this desire to do something.
How many of you are there now?
There's eight of us. So we operated as a collective, you know, we shared everything. We all got an equal say in everything that the band did and we all got paid exactly the same. And we're all credited as songwriters. No matter what your contribution was to a particular song, it was the idea that we operated as a group of people. So it feels like that group of people are my that's my family in a way. And it's it was quite a moving moment getting everybody together to discuss what we did, because everybody had a different version of what had happened as well. You know, you talk about the Brits thing, for instance, somebody tells one story, one person would say, "That was my idea to do that." And then somebody else would say, "Actually, no, I'm sure it was my idea." So there was a lot of that, you know. So it was great that we sort of dissected. And we don't all have the same sort of, you know, we're not all the same. You know, we don't have the same politics. You know, we all are all slightly differently to the left and all get involved in stuff to different degrees. But the fact of the matter is that we went through this whole thing together and can still, you know, and it's informed everything else that we've ever done. You know, it's given us the confidence to go on and do all these other things. And part of the film is also about trying to find that next generation of people who are doing those things as well.
What about that? You've influenced a generation of musicians, and what do you have to say to them about music and activism, and who do you see as those who are inheriting your legacy and carrying it on?
Well, it's weird. Actually being in New York, we talked to the Downtown Boys just the other day, and I found doing that interview as inspiring as hopefully somebody would have found watching Chumbawamba 20 years ago. You know, because it makes you aware of the fact that there are people who are still out there who have that passion and that drive, you know, and that sense of wanting to change how things are. And then you find out that, you know, that the first record they ever bought was Tub Thumping or something like that, you know, and you think that is brilliant that we're passing on, you know, we're passing something on. I mean, I still want to be involved in that, you know, in that sort of agitational propaganda pop world. I still feel as though I've got a role in that. But I love the fact that there's all these younger people who are doing the same thing.
And you've got a new band.
I have, yes, yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Interrobang.
Where did you get Interrobang?
It's a symbol. It's like a combination of a question mark and an exclamation mark. And it's like it's gone out of fashion. And I just loved the idea that this thing was like... It was like sort of something questioning, but at the same time, it's something like it's shouting out as well.
Choose a piece that we should play from Interrobang, one of your songs.
There is a video for a song called Are You Ready, People?, which is sort of a call to arms.
Are you ready, people?
Compromises. I don't care about rebel stances. I don't talk about blank stances. I don't think about lack of substance. I don't need that ersatz rebellion. I still dream of revolution. Compromises.
Ready, People by Interrobang, and Dunstan Bruce is the lead singer in this and his new band. We're also going to play, you talk about Downtown Boys. So Joey happens to be here of Downtown Boys. What are you going to play for us right now?
We're going to do a spoken word improvisational piece because I just met Joey the other day and we connected on so many things, and Victoria from Downtown Boys assured me that he was an absolutely brilliant musician and he'd be able to do this, and he's really into doing it. So we decided that we would do a combination of some Interrobang stuff that I do as a spoken word piece, and he's going to accompany me on guitar.
Joey of Downtown Boys and Dunstan Bruce.
Remember when we tried to turn the world upside down, but then we got ironic and sardonic messed around? The world keeps on revolving, but nothing's ever changed. But here I am, still passionate with a bottle full of rage. Sometimes you don't realize what you're doing till it's done, and sometimes, like a great idea, its time has come. And that time is now. I'm back in the fray. I've still got something to say, and I don't want to fade away. And I'm here, now, right here, now. So, are you ready, people? You've got to be ready. Because I'm old-fashioned, and yes, I still believe I am somebody. We all are. I don't care about my figure, but I'd love to sing about something. I'm no preacher performing miracles, but I'd like a laxative for the limousine liberals. I don't want to be absorbed by everything I loathe. The meek will just inherit nout. Nothing, nothing, nout. I don't talk about rebel stances. I don't think about bland stanzas. I don't need that ersatz rebellion. I still dream of revolution. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I thought we'd change the world in oh so many ways. I thought we'd rip it up and start all over again, destroy the old regime and change the conversation. I skimmed through volumes of situationist texts, occasionally managed some unsatisfactory sex. I told an anecdote about looking for the antidote. I rewrote a Chomsky quote and I learnt it by rote. I was cooking on gas, but then it went out. I was cooking on gas, but then it went out. I was cooking on gas, but then it went out. Then I embraced it all at 51. I can see clearly now the clouds have gone. So beat it, self-indulgent, repugnant crap. All that verbose, bellicose, trite BS. Here's another status update. Nothing is ever so black and white. There's 50 shades of grey, and it's not all that. And now I just accept all the good and the bad. All the good and the bad. And I'm good. And I'm bad. And I'm sick to death of being told to keep calm. There's no danger of that happening anytime soon. I'm angry, still angry after all these years. I'll never calm down. Never, ever. I really don't care if sincerity's uncool. Because now is the time to stop playing the fool. I'm sick of being pushed and hushed and crushed. I've had enough of standing in the middle of the road. Have you seen that film Network from 76 when Howard Beale delivers that passionate speech? He says, I don't need to tell you things are bad. He says, I don't need to tell you. It's time to get mad. He says, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. He says, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. He says, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore. He says, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
That's Joey DeFrancesco of Downtown Boys and Dunstan Bruce of Interrobang, and before that, Chumbawamba. That's right, a founding member of the anarcho-punk pop band Chumbawamba, who's now directing the forthcoming documentary, I Get Knocked Down, The Untold Story of Chumbawamba. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.